Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and this is the Downtime Podcast, where I take you behind the scenes of downhill and enduro mountain biking and meet the characters involved in making this sport great. This episode is supported by PNW Components. I've been running a PNW dropper and loam lever remote for over a year now, all the way through a pretty nasty British winter, and it's still working perfectly with literally no maintenance. And I genuinely cannot say that about any other dropper post I've ever used. They've got a new version of the Rainier dropper that is available to pre-order now, and it's got a super simple adjustment system so you can tune it to your perfect drop. They've also managed to reduce the overall length of the post. I've got one on the way and it should mean that I can move from 150mm dropped up to 170, which gives me even more room to move around on the bike when things get a bit tasty. In the last week, they've also launched PNW Cycled, where they're refurbishing new seat posts and making them available at a lower price, with a warranty and saving on waste at the same time. It's great to see companies taking their environmental responsibilities seriously. Good work, PNW. You can check out everything they have to offer at pnwcomponents.com, and as a special treat for all you Downtime listeners, they're offering you 15% off during May using the code PNWDOWNTIME, all lowercase, all one word, at the checkout. You can find the link and the code in the show notes for this episode over on downtimepodcast.com. Downtime Live is back this Wednesday, the 20th of May at 8pm BST, where I'll be joined by Coach to the Stars, Chris Kilmurray, aka Point One Athletic. Chris is coached to riders like Tani Seagrave and Charlie Harrison, amongst many others, and is a real wealth of knowledge when it comes to going fast. So head to youtube.com/downtime mountain bike podcast now, subscribe to the channel and set yourself a reminder to join us for the chat. You can either submit your questions now on our social media posts or during the episode by putting them in the live chat. Hopefully we'll see a load of you there, but if you can't make it, the video will be on our YouTube channel afterwards so you can watch it on catch up. To make sure you get your weekly fix of the audio version of the podcast, then head to downtimepodcast.com/subscribe. There's links there to help you do it on whatever platform's best for you. While you're at it, you can join our newsletter to receive our weekly weekend warm-up email for a few bits of interesting bike-related stuff come into your inbox on a Friday. A lot of you have been in touch asking when you've been able to buy a Downtime t-shirt again. Well, merch sales are still closed to give our amazing delivery folk the ability to focus on delivering key items for people in need. But as things are starting to ease up a little here, I'm looking to reopen the store in the next couple of weeks. So keep an eye out on downtimepodcast.com/shop for that. And I'll let you know here when it's open. Right, it's time to chat to this week's guest, Finn Isles. Finn was the biggest junior name of his era, winning Crankworx whip-offs at a young age and taking the Junior World Cup by storm. We chat about his background in ski racing, how important that whip-off win really was, and how you go from being in hospital on a backboard to becoming world champion in the same week. We discuss the pressure that his amazing junior career put on him as he entered elites, and how he's working to manage that, including training while he's in bed. We talk about his testing process, these specialised mullet bikes, and plenty more. So without further ado, here's Finn Isles. Finn Isles, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. How's things with you?
Yeah, pretty good. Thanks for having me. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thanks. Sunny day here, just coming to a close, and a sunny day starting for you, I think. So.
Yeah, very beautiful day. We've had rain for the last couple days in a row, so today looks like it's going to be a bit of a stunner.
Nice. Yeah, the rain seems to have randomly disappeared from the UK for like the last 6 weeks. It's incredible. It's a shame, shame that we can't go riding anywhere. But
yeah, I was going to say, just in time for quarantine, it seems like all winter you guys have had the worst weather of all time, and yeah. A bit unlucky, I guess.
Yeah, that sounds about right. But yeah, such is life. We'll live. Yeah. Cool. Let's wind the clock back for you then. Tell us a little bit about what life was like for you growing up, because I think it was Banff where you were born, and obviously skiing and ice hockey were big parts of your life living there.
Yeah, absolutely. Growing up in Canada, in the Rocky Mountains, basically you just start out on snow. And I grew up skiing. I grew up playing hockey because those are Canada's sort of most known winter sports. And my parents were really into skiing, and my dad was really into hockey as a kid. So for me growing up as a kid, those were the things I actually did the most of anything. And then both my parents rode bikes. My mom actually works for a company that does, like multi-sport trips around the world. And, biking is one of those things. So we would go biking as a family, and I sort of picked that up, but my main sports as a kid growing up were hockey and skiing.
Okay. And you had an older brother, is it Jack?
Yeah, I have an older brother, Jack, who also did a lot of the same things as me. He was sort of my influence into biking, that's for sure.
Yeah. And is that part of where your competitive nature comes from, like trying to keep up with him?
I would say so. I feel like the younger brother always feels like they have something to prove. So they got that competitive spirit because they're always trying to beat their sibling at something.
Yeah, yeah. Can you remember your early bike rides with Jack?
I don't remember too much of like the really early stuff, but I definitely remember a lot of the stuff when I was sort of 8, 9 years old and he was 12, and I was sort of like trying to keep up with him, like, oh, how long can I keep him in my eyesight, or you know, just little things like that.
Yeah, nice. And were you at that point, were you starting to go to Whistler and do some of the riding there?
Yeah, absolutely. That was sort of like the lead up to moving to Whistler. My family would go there in the summer. It started 1 year. We went for a week, and then we went for 2 weeks, and then we went for 3 weeks, and then we started coming in the winter to go skiing as well. So it sort of turned into this 2 trips a year for 3 weeks at a time. And my parents were like, why don't we just move there? And we did.
you must have been stoked. How old were you at the time?
I was 8. I was 9 when we moved.
Yeah.
Banff is a really beautiful place, and there's really good skiing. And obviously, I played hockey then, so it was like they had a good hockey team, and the biking wasn't amazing, but we sort of had everything we needed. But Whistler was just that one step better because the facilities in Whistler are pretty fantastic, obviously, as the bike park and the ski hill are known worldwide.
Yeah, definitely. So what were you up to, like, competitive wise at that sort of 9, 10, 11 age? Were you were skiing competitively? Yeah,
I would say ski racing and hockey, because I still wasn't old enough to race bikes, but in the winter I was basically 50-50 between skiing and hockey. So I'd go ski training on the weekends, and it would be Saturday. I'd go ski training in the morning, and then at 3:15 on Saturday afternoon, I'd have a hockey game. So I'd have to cut training early to go play hockey. And it was sort of like that battle between choosing what I wanted to do in the winter, but both sports were sort of had my heart, I guess, yeah, to say.
Did you, I mean, you excelled in both, right? You were pretty good in both of those disciplines.
Yeah, I'd say I was a better skier than I was a hockey player, but Whistler had a really good team the year that the year I quit. So our team went to provincial championships, and we won provincial championships for our tier. And then that was sort of the year I quit, because we had to make a choice, because after that year it gets really serious. And then in skiing, I was BC champion a couple times, Western Canada champion a couple times, and then we have like an international race called Whistler Cup it's like a kids international race, and I won that a few times. So I'd say I was pretty competitive in both, but definitely a better skier than hockey player.
Yeah. And did you ever see your future as being a professional skier? Is that something you dreamed about?
Absolutely. It was actually quite a back and forth between skiing and biking for a few years. It was something that I struggled with a lot, especially being like 14, 15 years old and having to make that decision where it's like, ooh, like I love both of these things and I have to make a decision now. And that was pretty tough, but evidently I ended up with biking.
Yeah. What was it then that gave biking the advantage in your 14-year-old head at the time?
To be honest, it was weird, because I had just finished a ski season and I had like quite a good year. Like a lot of my really good friends back then were ski racers. So I just spend my time skiing and competing with a lot of my good friends. And I was like, I'm going to be a skier. And then my parents were like, well, let's just see how this bike season goes. And it was opening weekend at Whistler Bike Park, and I had just gotten a new bike, and it was like a Trek Session 26-inch, I think. And it was like my first sort of big real downhill bike. And I went to opening weekend and I was just ripping with all my friends that ride bikes, and now my really close friends. And I had a really good weekend, and I came home at the end of the weekend. I was like, Mom, Dad, I don't want to go to ski camp next week. I think this is it. And that was it. That was basically the choice. We have like a May ski camp every year in Whistler. And I just chose not to go, because I was like, I just want to ride my bike. Like, this is too much fun. And that was that.
That's cool. So it totally just came down to where your passion lied, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. It was sort of the thing that I loved most, and it still is to this day. So I'm pretty happy that I made that choice.
Yeah, good choice. So you're 14 years old, Crankworx is coming to your hometown of Whistler, and you must have known you were pretty handy in the air and you wanted to get involved with whip-offs, but you're too young. Talk us through how that kind of ended up getting overruled.
Yeah, that was a crazy summer. I wasn't the year before, there was a small whip-off at another like local race, and I did pretty, like, I think I won that one, and I was like, oh, like, this is sort of something that comes naturally to me. It's really fun. And in Whistler, me and my friend Magnus, basically, we just lived at Magnus lived at my house for the whole summer, and we rode the bike park basically every day, and we were just riding crab hits because they had just rebuilt them. And I was like, oh, like, this is sick. Like, I'm so excited to do the whip off this year at Crankworx, because before, they had always let basically anyone come in that was able to enter into Crankworx. So if you're like 13 and older, you were allowed to be in it. And the year before, I'd been injured, so I was really particularly looking forward to this one. And then I like posted about it, and I go to sign up for it, and they're like 18 years old and older only.
Oh, man.
So that was a bit frustrating, especially because I was like, oh, like, you know, I was looking forward to it so much. And then I posted a couple of videos of me doing whips, and like somebody, I think Katrina Strand sort of talked to somebody at Vital, and they were like, oh yeah, we should make a video about this. And so a guy named Lear and Brandon Terman from Vital came out, and they shot a video with me in the Whistler Bike Park, basically putting a spotlight on my whips and my riding. And they posted that with the whole Let Finn In thing. And I don't know what exactly happened, but I didn't think it was going to work. I mean, it caught a lot of momentum, but as Crankworx sort of rolled around, I had no answer. And then it was the day of the first race, and I got the news that I was going to be able to do it. And that was really exciting. And I think there was a lot of people behind the scenes that had a lot to do with that, that I don't really know about because I was quite young and nobody's really told me about it. But yeah, there's definitely a lot of moving parts there. And then they finally let me in. And that was something that was pretty special, because that whip off sort of kickstarted my career and got me noticed.
Yeah. I heard that even Travis Pastrana was backing you and trying to help get you in.
Yeah. Yeah. He was there. I think I met him. He was, that was pretty cool. I only talked to him for about 10 seconds, but that was definitely a pretty cool experience meeting him when I was 14.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. What was it like then? So you're riding whip-offs in your hometown with literally, I guess, the vast majority of your biking heroes.
Yeah. That was a crazy feeling. I'd been to like summer gravity camp a couple times, and I got to ride with like a Kamikal, a Jordy Lund, Andrew Shandro, you know, like they have a lot of big names at that camp, but it was nothing like that, because it wasn't like I was being coached. It was more along the lines of me being equal to them and like actually going out and like riding, you know. I was just like one of the guys out there. So being 14, having that was something pretty spectacular, because you go to Crankworx as a kid, and I think I'd been to every single one at that point. So it was sort of surreal, because I was able to be a part of it and ride with these people that had been my hero and like legends in my own eyes.
Yeah. I saw a video clip of it, and I'm fairly sure you said in that, I want to win this thing. Did you really believe at that point that you could win the whip-offs?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think I would have been a part of that video or made that video if I didn't think that I could have won. As much as I was still just a kid, I've been really competitive since I can remember. So I think I was pretty confident in the fact that I thought I could win, or at least get a top three. Yeah, that was that video. My parents watch it all the time. My mom always cries because she's like, oh, like, you know, whatever. It's that attitude that I've sort of had my whole life.
Yeah, where does that come from, that confidence? Because as a 14-year-old in that environment, most people would just be freaking the hell out, and that yet you're there with a presence and thinking, right, hang on, I can win this. What gives you that sort of swagger, I guess?
It's hard to say. I think that riding with my brother a lot as a kid, I became friends with a lot of older people, or older kids, I guess. So I spent a lot of time being like the young kid, the small kid. So I sort of had to have that, like, a little bit of confidence around them. I mean, it definitely for a little while would have been more arrogance than anything, but I think I sort of reached a point where it was more of a confidence in my ability and just a general belief in myself. And I've sort of held that my whole life, and I'm not sure why, but maybe it's just because I've been competing in skiing and hockey and whatever other sport I compete in. It's sort of prepared me for to have that confidence and to believe in myself for all types of competitions.
Yeah, it's a good place to be for sure. So how did it feel then to take the win at that competition, to beat a load of those guys and take the win on the day?
That was very special. I still think that's one of my favorite memories of all time. Looking back at it, it sort of felt like I was just out there riding my bike with a bunch of people that I looked up to, and I sort of just wanted to prove myself. And then winning was something that was I could only dream of, and being able to do that sort of, like I said, kickstarted everything for me, because from there, I got a ride with Lapierre, and I'm still on the team now.
Yeah. So what happened? Were you approached by many people after that? Because obviously it definitely elevated you in the mountain biking world.
Definitely. I went to Mont Saint-Anne earlier in the year to watch my brother race at the World Cup there. And me and my friend Magnus were forerunning the race. We like emailed Cycling Canada a couple months beforehand. We're like, hey, can we come out to Mont Saint-Anne and forerun? So we were out there watching my brother and forerunning the track. And Sam Blenkinsop, I think, saw me on track, and he sort of yelled at me and gave me like a woo, you know? and Blanky at the time was one of my favorite riders, so that was pretty cool. And I like didn't really think much of it. Like, he was just stoked because, I don't know, I was a small guy just riding the track. And then I got to the finish line on qualifying day because I opened the men's qualifying session. And I came down and I walked up into the bleachers, and the Lapierre team manager, Laurent Delorme, who's still my team manager, came up to me and he's like, what's your name? And I told him my name. I told him where I was from. And I strolled past him. Like, I actually had no idea who he was. I thought he was just a French Canadian guy, if I'm totally honest. Then my friend Magnus said, do you know who that is? And I said, no. And he's like, well, that's the Lapierre team manager. And he's like, you should go talk to that guy. So I turn around, walk back down, and I like reintroduce myself and asked him about a few things, and he gave me his email, and he said, come by the tent later. We'd like to talk to you. And so I went by the tent later, talked to him with my mom and my dad. He sort of sent us like a thing that he wanted to do with me. It wasn't like a big offer or anything, but it was sort of like, we want to give you a bike and like you can race in Canada. And then when junior rolls around, like we could potentially bring you out to Europe. And then the whip off happened. And then he re-upped his offer and he was like, we want you to come to Europe. We want you to do this. We want you to do that in the following year. And it was like, from then on, everything has been amazing. But yeah, I think there was a few other offers in there for sure. But right from the beginning, my heart was set on joining the team. Honestly, it's because Sam Blenkinsop was there, because he was one of my favorite riders, and he actually left the team the year that I joined.
But I was going to say, yeah, he moved to Norco, right?
Yeah, exactly. But then Loic and Loris were there, and they were both really friendly and open to have me on the team. And I'm sure the first couple of years I was quite annoying, but as I've gotten older, I think I've become less annoying.
That's a good thing. Nice one. So yeah, they took you on board, and you were too young to race at World Cup at that point, weren't you? I think there was one year where you raced like internationally, but not at World Cup level. Did you find that helpful preparation to be getting used to the traveling side of things? And because a lot of juniors don't get that.
Yeah, that was, I definitely got a bit of a head start there on everybody else with the traveling to Europe and sort of, I'd say, getting used to racing different competition, because in Canada we have a really good race series called the BC Cup that I grew up racing, but it's nothing compared to going over there and racing an IXS or you know, like a Crankworx Europe or forerunning a World Cup, just because it's such a different scene and it's so weird racing out of your home even province. I definitely think that was something that helped me out a lot, because I got used to being away from my parents and sort of being away from stuff that's familiar. And I feel like that's something that the Europeans, the French, the Brits, and those those overseas people get that the North Americans just don't, that they just don't have, because in Canada, we race in Canada and we only race Canadians and then a few Americans if we decide to go race down there. And the British kids and the French kids always have a head start, I feel, because they have such a well-developed race series in their country that's sort of nationwide. And mm-hmm. I think that they, you know, like, get to race each other, get to race other countries because everything's so close over there, and get used to like the rougher, steeper, faster tracks. And yeah. I feel like the North Americans are at a slight disadvantage. And I felt like I was lucky enough to be able to come over and do that. And it was a bit more of an even playing field that way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it prepared you pretty well for your junior campaign.
I was going to say, for sure.
Do you remember much about your first World Cup? It was Lourdes, wasn't it? Would it have been 2016?
Yeah. Yeah. Lourdes 2016. Yeah. That was a crazy experience. I definitely didn't think I was going to be able to win my first World Cup, but, it was funny because I felt like I had been riding good all week. And like, I don't know how much faith the team had in me to do that well, I guess. I think they were sort of expecting like a, you know, a top 10, like a solid result. And in qualifying, I was second at every single split until the very last one. And I rode off the track into a fence and I got my bike stuck. So I had to yank it out and I came down and I was in 16th place, but all my splits were really good. So they were like, well, you should like just sort of, you know, keep it tame, have a good run tomorrow. And it looks like you should be in like the top five sort of thing. And I don't know what it is, but I think it's not so much a like want to win. It's more of like a not want to lose type thing that I have okay. with myself. So I went out and sort of pushed as hard as I could. And I ended up winning that race. And then everything sort of kickstarted from there. But yeah, that was pretty special because that crowd was so big, and that being my first race, I think that was an exceptional experience for me.
Yeah, and a perfect way to boost your confidence to win your first ever World Cup.
Absolutely. That's something that, you know, you can't get from anything else. You know, you show up and you're not really sure where you stand. You're not sure if you get like a fifth, you're like, yeah, I'm riding good. I'm riding well. But just by winning, I was like, all right, this is my season. It's like, I'm the fastest rider here, you know?
Yeah. And you also attracted, I guess, more attention than quite a lot of the other junior riders do at that stage, because you had that almost fame that you'd built through the Whip-Off thing and all the coverage around that. You're straight into one of the biggest teams. You're riding alongside Lois and Lorik. Can't even say their names. Lorik, Loris. There's a lot of eyes on you. How did you cope with that? Because that's that's a lot of attention for someone at that age.
Yeah, that was I was really lucky to be able to be part of the I guess it would be the Lapierre team at that point, because Laurent is he's had a lot of experience working with juniors, and he sort of raised Loic and raised Loris through the ranks, and they were both junior world champion. And he has this knowledge of how to sort of treat us and guide us into being a little bit more calm and intelligent with our racing. And I think that he helped so much with that, because like you said, there was a lot of noise around my name after the Whip-Off, and then me going to Europe and actually being at the World Cups. Like, a lot of the photographers and the teams and the media had seen me ride. So there was sort of like a bigger hype around my name than I think anybody else coming into junior.
Yeah.
And Laurent sort of kept me grounded in that way, because he just has a lot of experience and he had a lot of advice. And, without him, I don't think I would have done nearly as well as I did in my my junior career.
Yeah, what sort of advice did he give then? Can you remember much of what he did to help you in those early phases?
A lot of it was like, it's stuff that isn't too complicated, but it's stuff that you wouldn't really realize on your own, because you would get too caught up in, oh, like, was I riding this section fast? Like, you know, is like, are people seeing that I'm riding fast? Am I riding fast? Like, sort of, you know, the stuff that goes through your head when, I guess, you're a kid. Mm-hmm. And he sort of gave the advice of just take it slowly, calm down, believe in your own ability to ride a bike. You know, there's a reason you're here. It's not just, you know, you're fast, you're good on a bike. And then the big one was ride at 85% and don't over push yourself, because that'll lead to crashing. And the most important thing for the entire year is the overall and then world championships. Mm-hmm. And so the 85% thing was really important in my first year, because a lot of the races I would ride at 85% of my speed and I would get down and I would have really consistently good runs. And I find that a lot of juniors wouldn't do that. They'd ride 100% and then they'd have a crash, and then they'd have a good split and then they'd crash. And I sort of had a consistency throughout that first season in junior. And there was a few races where I definitely let it loose and had some really, really good runs, but that's more of a feeling or a in the moment type thing. But for the most part, we had that plan set, and it worked really well in my favor. And that's something that I learned from Laurent, and actually talking about it now, I need to be bringing into my racing, my racing coming into this year.
Fair play. Well, let's talk a bit about 2016, your first attempt at world champs. It was in Val de Sole. Mm-hmm. And yeah. You had a pretty tough week, yeah?
Yeah, that was a bit of a whirlwind. I think that I tend to do better when I don't know. I feel like when I'm an underdog almost, I'm not sure if that's the right word for it, but first day of practice, I was pushing myself every single run. I was like, first run, I could have done my race run after my second or third run. Like, I was like ready to go. I was like so hyped. I'm like, world champs, this is my race. Like, you know, I'm going to go for a win in elites, you know, like kind of one of those. I don't know where the confidence was coming from, but it was there. And on my fourth run, I went over the bars and I thought I broke my neck. So I got evac'd off the hill and I went to the hospital, and I was in the hospital for about 4 hours and they did scans on my neck. Like, I was on the backboard. I couldn't move for 4 hours. It was really actually a really scary experience. I think I might've had, looking back on it now, like a bit of a concussion, because there's a lot of moments that are quite blurry in there. And I cleared all the tests. Like, I had no neck damage. He said my vertebrae were stretched, and he said probably shouldn't do anything for 2 weeks. And then we're like, well, we have a race on Sunday. He's like, I would not recommend doing that. Just because it's going to hurt your neck a lot, like this, that, and the other thing. And he gave me a neck brace and I wore it for the first day, and like my face was all bruised up and I looked like I'd been in a car accident basically. And then I woke up one day, we have a masseur on the team, and his name's Werner. He's the man. He's so good at what he does. And he sort of helped me and tried to tune me up, and then, took a bit of painkillers and I tried to ride and I could barely hold on. And then I got taped up and I got needled and all this. And then race day comes around and I got two more runs. So I think I'd done a total of 7 runs on the weekend. And then I went into race run, and, I don't know what happened. It was just sort of like one of those things where it was like, you're so in the moment that nothing matters. You can't, like, everything sort of goes numb and it just happens. So I think all the pain sort of just went away from my body, and I was just like so hyper focused on the race, and I won. So that was pretty amazing.
Yeah, first season junior taking the world champs must have felt pretty good, especially after a week like that.
Yeah, that was something that was pretty incredible. And my friend Magnus, who I keep talking about, I spend a lot of time with him, finished second. So it was like a pretty big weekend for Canada. And it was the year that Stevie had passed away. So it was something that we're sort of starting to carry on his legacy from there.
Nice. Yeah, that's really nice. How did you turn that around then, to come from being stuck on a backboard, immobilized, fearing that you've broken your neck, to being able to go down Val de Sole fast enough to win? Like, how do you control the fear?
That's a good question. I find that if you start fearing or start being afraid of going fast, then it's basically just over. I think that you have to have that confidence that crashes happen, things happen, but you've done this so many times that it's you can do it again. And I'm not sure where that comes from, but it's the same as things that have happened over the years since then. It's like, I have a big crash and I'm potentially get injured, or I'm like hurting pretty bad, but I just get back up and you get back on your bike, because if once you're afraid, you'll never come back from that place.
Fair play. That's impressive stuff. So yeah, you took the confidence, I guess, from that first season into 2017, and it was nearly the perfect season, but Matt Walker pipped you to the post in Fort William and pushed you back into second. Was that frustrating for you? Like, how did you feel about it? Because it was fairly early in the season, I suppose.
Yeah. Matt has been sort of my nemesis, I guess to say, since the beginning of my racing career internationally. But he's an incredible rider, and he's a really good rider. So I was expecting some stiff competition in that second year for sure. And I mean, when somebody beats you fair and square, you can't be mad about that. So he definitely rode super well at that race and he won, but I think that gave me a little bit more motivation to try and push harder and go faster for the rest of the season. Cause I won that first race and I don't know if I got overconfident or anything. But coming into Fort William, I think I was a little bit too confident, and I had a pretty big mistake in my race run, but nothing that would have cost me 5 seconds. Cause he definitely crushed me at that one. But from there on, it was sort of this is my season. I want to win everything sort of after that. Cause losing to him was quite frustrating.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely drove you through the rest of the season. Like I say, you took all the wins, and that, I guess, is really good, but it put a huge amount of expectation on you being the name to watch when you moved into Elite the following year. How did you feel about that?
Yeah. That second year of junior was pretty crazy. Matt had a lot of bad luck. So there was a few races that I'm sure he would have given me a run for my money and would have been a lot more tightly contested had he not been injured or had he finished. But coming into Elite, I'd say overly confident. Something that's kind of obviously, I think a reoccurring thing in my life. I just get a little bit too confident if I do something quite well. And I sort of put the expectation on myself that I could win. Like, I could win, not my first race, but I sort of had this weird thing in my back of my mind, like, oh, like, this is exactly like junior. You're going to come in, you're going to win your first race, and Bob's your uncle. And like that's just how it's going to go. And obviously that's not how it went. And it's something that's been difficult. It's been a difficult transition for me, because that all that expectation, I wouldn't say it comes from anyone else. Well, it comes from other places, but most of the expectation that I feel is coming from within myself, because I have this high expectation of myself that I can win and I will win. And I think that I just came in a little bit too overconfident and tried to push a little bit too hard. And that's a lesson that I've been trying to learn over the past 2 years, because I can't seem to get the reins on it. But that was a hard season coming in and having such a good second year of junior and coming into Elite and just getting ragdolled, I guess to say.
Yeah, it was a bit of a brutal ride, I guess, because I think it was 56th place in Lozenge was how it kicked off.
Yeah.
And then kind of improvement to Fort William in 19th, Leah going back to 40th. But then it looked like it was starting to come together. So Val de Sol, you qualified second, I think, and then had an eighth place. Did you start to think, oh, okay, hang on a minute, maybe I've got the hang of this?
Yeah, absolutely. That first race, I crashed. I was top 15, I think, at the first two splits. And then I had a crash. And crashes happen, and like obviously there's some jitters. So I was like, whatever. I don't crash very often. That's that. And then second race, Fort William. It's quite long. It's a hard track. So I think that one I was a little bit more focused on just like getting down and getting a result. I think I sort of went back to that 85% rule there. And then in Leo Gang, I was like, all right, I got a result under my belt. Time to go again. And same thing happened. I just pushed too hard. And then from there on, it was sort of, instead of focusing on the end result, I need to start focusing on how I'm riding and start focusing on just doing what I do. And then the next two races went really well. And those two tracks, Val de Sol and Andorra, are my two favorite tracks. So there are places that I've always succeeded and places that I feel like suit my riding the best because they're steep and rough and fast. And I think that gave me a good confidence boost coming into there.
Yeah. And you got your first elite podium then in Val Nord.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a special moment. That was pretty cool. That was a good feeling.
Yeah. So obviously, again, you're building through that season. The confidence, I'm guessing, is kind of coming back up. And yeah, then you're on home turf in Mont-Saint-Anne. Are you then piling that expectation back on yourself again?
I think I got out of the mindset of expecting really, I don't know if expecting big things is the word. I think I had gotten in the right mindset for racing. I still expected big things of myself, but I was less focused on that and more focused on being like, look at your previous two results. You're on pace. You just need to, I don't know, ride your bike. And I had that same mindset going into Mont-Saint-Anne. And that one was something where I was just a little bit unlucky and I had a crash, but I definitely felt like Mont-Saint-Anne was the best I had ridden all of that season, with a flat in qualifying with ninth. And then in my race run, I think I was third or fourth at the first couple splits before I crashed. And that was just something that happens when you're trying to ride that fast, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. It's inevitable. Mm-hmm. So did you change much between 2018 and 2019 seasons? Obviously there was the change to the bike. You guys did quite a lot of work in the off season and moved to the mixed wheel size.
Yeah. There was a change in my training. I think I trained a lot harder coming into my second year of elite. It was a bit, I think I came in with a similar mindset to the first year. It was sort of more like that was just your first year, you know, you get unlucky, but this year will be different. But I came in with the exact same mindset. I didn't change anything in my mind besides my training and my bike. And obviously you can change all you want, but if your mind's not in the right place, you're not gonna be able to, you know, accomplish as much as you want, because mind, I'd say, is like, I don't know, 50% of racing. Yeah. So that's something I struggled with a lot, actually. Besides Fort William last year, I sort of got into my own head, which was, it was hard. I had to dig pretty deep last year to sort of dig myself out of that hole that I put myself into. I got to a point mid-season in Leger, I crashed, and I can't even remember what happened. Like, I was just riding. I wasn't even thinking about the result or anything. And I just lost my front wheel and I was in the dirt, and I was like my third race in a row of crashing. And I was like, I was in the finish line and I was like hyperventilating. I was like crying. I was like, how am I not able to finish a single race run? Like, this is something that shouldn't be happening. And I was like, why am I even here? Like, I'm just like letting everybody down. And I sort of got away from myself and stopped focusing on my own riding and focused a lot on what other people were sort of seeing of me or like thinking of me, in terms of my racing, because I sort of got so low that I, was just sort of lost, I'd say.
I'm surprised almost to hear that, because you come across as being a very confident person in your own ability and what you're capable of. So to be knocked down that hard, like that must have been really hard.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was tough. I think that's like the first time in my life where I'd really, I guess in my own eyes at the time, had failed at something. Since I was a kid, I've always been, I don't know, successful in, I don't know, team sports, individual sports, whatever. And I'd like always sort of had this success. And I think that was a bit of a shock to the system. And that's why I had struggled so hard, was because I didn't know how to handle myself. And I was sort of on foreign territory where I was like, why am I sucking? Like, why can't I finish? Why can't I do this? Why can't I do that? And I was just sort of beating myself up. And there's still a confidence there, but it's very shallow, I'd say. And after Leger, I definitely had to do some thinking and some digging into myself to sort of figure out what I had to do to figure this out, because it was something that it's not sustainable to have three bad races and then one good result and then three bad races and then one good result. And just, I was so, my body was so beat up and my mind was so beat up, like just crashes and not finishing race runs. And yeah, it was really tough, but, the end of the season got a bit better and I started working with a mental coach and I feel like that's helped me a lot. And I felt really confident coming into this season until the coronavirus.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a bit maybe. So when did you take on or start working with a sports psychologist?
That was, let's say, August last year, before World Championships.
And how was that first session? Because I think that's often the eye-opening one for people.
Yeah, it was good. It was, I think, eye-opening for me too, because I never really looked in upon myself, like I'd never really dug into myself, like even just scratched the surface. I just sort of had this blind confidence that I could just do it and it would be fine. And that's all that I needed to do. So going there, and we sort of do this thing where you reveal what you think you're the best at and what you think you're the worst at, was like the first couple things we did. And then just from there, it sort of kickstarted. But I think that the main things I took away from that were the things that I was good at. And I just needed to keep that belief and just trust that I know what I'm doing. Like, I've ridden a bike since I was 5 years old. I just need to get back to riding my bike instead of focusing on all these external things that I have absolutely no control over, or these external things that I'm worried about that I shouldn't be, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So how often do you see them? Is it an ongoing process, or have you just done a few sessions? Like, how does it work?
It's definitely an ongoing process. It's definitely like your body, you got to train it. And, I have a lot of stuff that I work on that he gives me to work on. But it's an ongoing thing. I talk to him about, I don't know, I think I talked to him 4 times this winter over Skype, just hourly sessions. And then after, he'll send me a sum up of what we talked about and things that I need to work on. So I've been doing a lot of mental work on my own this winter, and stuff that I feel like I've been really improving on. But yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. What sort of stuff might you do then? What might one of those exercises look like?
It's a lot about visualization. Let's just say I want to get in the race mindset. I'm not a race. Like, I have no, let's just say, how can I explain this? I don't get to race that much in the winter before World Cup. So I don't really get those reps in of like practicing being in the race mindset or going to races and being ready to go. So a lot of it is visualizing and like basically getting your mind to a point where it feels like you're at a race, but you could just be lying in your bed. So I've been doing a lot of work with visualization, and like I've always been quite good at sort of dreaming things up in my head. So I could be lying in bed and my heart rate's at like 150, like I'm sweating. I'm nervous. Like, I can feel the nerves and I'm lying in my bed and it feels like I'm at a race. So I've been working quite a lot on that and just getting like reps in to make it feel like I'm at a race. Like, the process of being in the start gate and keeping myself calm, and then the process of visualizing where I want that to go. Like how I want to ride that run, how I feel on my bike, and sort of just working through that, those feelings. There's a lot of other stuff that I do, but that's the most self-explanatory one there.
Yeah. So you're not relying on lucky underwear anymore.
I mean, a little bit, but I'm sort of having a little bit more self-belief.
Is it true that you've got lucky underwear though?
Yeah. Lucky underwear and socks. I have 2 pairs of each, actually.
And do they get worn in every race run?
Qualifying and race, yeah.
Whoa. Okay.
My socks,
a fresh set for each?
No, I have two pairs and I just wash them every race weekend.
Okay.
But I had one for all of junior, and then I lost at World Championships and I threw everything away. I said, that's it. And then I got some new stuff, but I haven't really been after last season, I think mid-season, I was like, this is stupid. I'm just so unlucky. These things, like, I don't need to believe in these things, but I think that it's always good to have a bit of superstition. Even if you do have bad races. Yeah, exactly. Even if you do have bad races, it still carries a bit of meaning for you.
And it's part of, it's one of those things that helps you feel more confident. You're like, well, I've got my lucky pants on. This is going to be good.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So you talk about like not being able to get into a race mindset very often. Is it right that you guys do kind of simulated race weekends when you're out testing in like in New Zealand?
Yeah, not too often, but this year in New Zealand, my mechanic, Kevin, and I sort of had a 2-day version of a race. We picked a new testing track and I walked the track. I picked all my lines and then I did 5 runs and we sort of built up through what we thought would be good settings on the bike. And then the following day I did 3 runs and then he said, all right, you want to do a race run. This is the setup that I feel like is going to be fastest for this track. And then I set a time for myself and I said, I'm going to beat this time. And then that sort of puts a little bit more of like a realism to it, a bit more of not pressure, I'd say, but it actually adds like a bit of a goal and there's something to strive for. And, that was cool because I feel like that's something that I've been missing a lot in my winter training is being against a clock or being up against, let's just say, a ghost. And I felt like that was really beneficial.
Yeah. And do you do that in isolation then? You don't pit yourself against Loic?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that was fully in isolation. Loic sort of has his own testing process and him and Jack follow their own plan. I've brought it up a couple times where I want to do an actual like testing race against him and just be like, this should be good for us. Like, why don't we get in the competitive spirit? You know, like it is what it is. And like, normally we don't have time for it either. He's too far along in his process or I'm too far along in mine, but, I'm sure we'll get around to it one day, but we haven't done it yet.
Okay. What other sorts of things are you doing then in that New Zealand testing slot?
We're mainly working on suspension. Obviously there's a lot of physical training going on while I'm down there. But most of the time we do 3 day riding blocks. So we'll do 3 days of riding and testing and then a day off, and then we'll switch to a new track and we'll do 3 days of riding and then take a day off and then switch to a new track and do 3 days of riding and then a day off. And that sort of keeps it feeling like a race weekend because it's 3 days and you have to work towards a goal or try and find what you're looking for. So Kevin and I will sort of start with a shock and he knows what he wants, but he doesn't really tell me exactly what he's looking for. And then that way I can focus more on what the bike's doing, without any, let's say guidance. I'm sort of trying to figure it out on my own.
Yeah. So it's about learning how to dial the bike in for all of those different conditions. Is that fair?
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say that's the gist of it. And then trying for all different tracks, whether it's rough or flat or whatever, trying to find a balance of both. And this year we did a lot of different stuff. We were playing around with different headset cups and front end length or front end lengths and bar width and bar height and tires and bottom bracket height. And there's a lot of stuff we actually worked on this year in New Zealand. And I felt like this is the first year where I've been really able to like to contribute to the testing process, because I felt like before I was too young. I hadn't spent enough time actually feeling what the bike is doing and I didn't know what I was looking for. And I felt like this year was sort of the first year where I was able to be really successful in finding the things that I like to have on the bike rather than just following the guidance of Loic or Kevin or Jack or Laurent. Yeah. And I felt like I sort of found my own way this winter, which was cool.
Yeah, that is cool. And are those decisions coming from feel or from timing or from other pieces of data? Like, how do you decide what bike you're going to actually end up running?
Yeah, it's a bit of both, or all things, I guess. It's weird because you can go up and feel the bike and be like, wow, that was absolutely amazing. And then I come down and Kevin's like, well, that was 4 seconds slower than the run previous. And then he'll like change the setup and I'll be like, that was horrible. That must have not been a good time. He's like, well, it was 5 seconds faster. So what are you going to do? And it's one of those things where it's like, sometimes you have these moments where your feelings and the time don't match up. And I think that it's more of finding something that you like to ride and then also having a good time. And it takes a lot of patience and work to get to that point, because Kevin will run these numbers and he'll be like, I think this will work. And then it'll like, I'll be so far off the back. And it's something that doesn't always make sense. But that's the point of testing, is to find all these different settings that work for me and work for the timing for all different types of tracks, because something that would work at Leogang wouldn't work in Val d'Isol, or something that works in Val d'Isol wouldn't work at Fort William. And it's sort of like finding that setting or the direction of settings we want to follow to be ready for that race.
Yeah. And do you think that puts you guys at an advantage? Because I'm not convinced every team is out doing that throughout the winter. So maybe they're having to work out those puzzles at the race weekends.
Yeah, I think that we are a very organized team. I think that Laurent has set up a very good program for us. So we are definitely, I'd say a step ahead of a lot of teams, but there's definitely teams out there that do a lot of work and obviously are always quite prepared for what's coming in the season. It's hard to say, but I feel like we are in a very good position with how we do things.
Yeah. And you've got the data acquisition as well now, haven't you? I think for a few years it was only Loic and Jack that had it, but now you're using it with Kevin for the last couple of years, is it?
Yeah, the last 2 years now. When I was in junior, I was like, oh, like, why can't I use it? Like this, that, and the other thing. Like, oh, like, whatever, Loic gets all this stuff. And it's like, well, first of all, I probably wouldn't have known what to do with it at that point. And I think it was more of like, oh, like, Loic gets it, why can't I have it, you know? And it was one of those things where I had to slow down and I think figure out what I was actually doing, because even coming into my first year elite, I was using it. And I was still sort of not sure on what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And then it wasn't, like I said, until this winter where I actually figured it out. And I think it was more of a, I need to care a lot about what is going on and that I actually understand what the bike is doing for me to go faster, instead of just being like, well, this was good, this was bad. It is what it is. Like I'll ride it. Like Kevin will figure it out. It's sort of like, I need to be more proactive in actually helping him make the bike faster and sort of figuring things out on my own. And that's something that I think takes a couple years to develop. And that's why they weren't so keen on me having the telemetry when I was younger. And then it's also super expensive and easy to break.
Yeah. I guess if you crash a bike with it on, there's a good chance of doing some damage.
For sure. For sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And so would you say you've become almost more of an engineer then? You understand more of the terminology and you're looking in detail at like how the bike's working and what you might want to change?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like I'm able to ride the bike and be like, come down to the bottom and be like, well, Kev, I felt like the bike was doing this here. And it was doing this there. And maybe if we do this, or maybe if we try this, we can improve it through these sections and it'll sit higher, it'll sit lower, it'll brake better, it won't squirm so much. And I feel like I have more of a knowledge of how everything works as well as what I'm feeling on the bike.
Yeah. Good stuff. So you're in a good setup and you've got a good teammate, right? You're chasing one of the fastest guys in the pack at the moment. Is it helpful having Loic on the team, or is it a hindrance, or are there elements of both?
I'd say it's only been helpful for me. He's definitely had struggles of his own throughout his career, and he's overcome them, and he's a very knowledgeable person, and it seems like he's very particular about what he likes. So he's sort of someone to look up to and see how he does things, because his process is definitely a little bit weird at times, but it seems like it works for him. And I think it's noticing that he sort of does stuff that he feels will benefit him, and what sort of makes him feel like he's going to be in the best place to race. And I feel like that's something I also learned this winter, was to not so much as just like, look what he's doing, be like, oh, like maybe I should be doing that. Like, oh, Loic's doing it. And I think I did a lot of that over the first few years on the team. And this winter, I sort of figured out that for me to succeed, I don't need to follow what he's doing, but I need to watch what he's doing and see how he does it. And then sort of take that into my own riding and my own lifestyle to sort of improve my own process to the way that I like it.
Yeah. So more like treating yourself as an equal.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. He must be a good guy to have on board.
For sure. Yeah. He's really funny. We're competitive at a lot of stuff. So sometimes it gets a bit tense because we're like playing FIFA and I win or he wins and somebody's gloating a little bit too hard and it gets a little bit, I don't know, tense, but for the most part, it's awesome having him as a teammate. It's really good to have somebody to look up to and sort of follow or try to follow in the footsteps of.
Yeah, it always feels like there's a good atmosphere in your pits. It seems like you've got a good crew there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about the mixed wheel size bike, because there's still, I guess, a lot of people don't fully appreciate what the benefits are. What was it about it that attracted you to it?
Well, to be honest, I didn't have too much of a say in the whole development of the mullet bike. I did get to ride the full 29er, and I wasn't the biggest fan when I first rode it. So that was something that Loic and I, we both tried that bike, and then we raced it in Leger, and both of us had pretty horrible results. Because it was like the very first iteration. Yeah. But from there, we sort of progressed the bike and sort of figured out what might work for us. And I think it was Loic and Jack that had sort of worked on the mullet bike. They worked alongside Specialized and we're like, well, maybe this will work. So we tried it out. And it definitely took a lot of testing. I think they did a lot more than I did because Jack and Loic live so close to each other. They're able to test a lot. So they put a lot of work into that and we sort of got to a place where we were happy with how the bike felt. And then it wasn't till about, I'd say New Zealand last year where I was quite sold on the bike. And then
took a bit of getting used to then.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was a weird thing because we had full carbon 27.5 bike and then we went to aluminum 29 and that was a shock to the system and then sort of found this happy medium with the mullet bike. And I personally really like the feeling of a mullet bike. I ride a 29er trail bike, but I prefer the mullet on the downhill side of things.
Why do you think it works better for downhill? Because it does seem to be more popular in that side of things.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure. I think that the jump to 29er was a bit premature just because the 650 bike had only been around for 3-4 years. So it hadn't really been fully tested, I'd say, or fully progressed to the place it could have gone to. So everybody went to 29er and it was sort of a race to get there and not a lot of bikes when we got there were that good. So it was something that we were like, maybe the mullet and it's sort of the best of both worlds. You get that grip in the front of the 29 and you get the quickness and like the snappiness of the 650 in the back. And I actually rode a friend's bike yesterday cause he has a full 29er downhill bike and I just wanted to give it a try and it's such an odd feeling compared to the mullet. I didn't think it would be that much of a difference, but it's pretty eye opening, honestly.
Interesting. So we were, like you say, we were heading fast into the 2020 season, which was going to be an early start with Lusa. Sounds like you were feeling pretty good and then coronavirus showed up. Like, how has that impacted you? How are you coping with it?
Yeah, that was I don't know. It's something that I don't think I'll experience in my racing career ever again, is just being so, you have this whole plan, this whole schedule, and you're like, we're doing this testing camp. We're doing this testing camp. We're doing this testing camp. And it's like, check, check, check. I'm riding fast. Race setup's ready. My mind's ready. And the day before you leave, first race canceled. And then it's like, all right, like it is what it is. Like we'll be ready for the second race in a month's time. And then it's like, well, you're not going to be racing until September. And it's a weird feeling because normally you have this schedule and these goals and then everything is so up in the air. Like right now we don't even know if we're going to be racing in September. So you don't have to strive or you don't have to set goals for yourself because there's nothing to, there's no date, there's no time to reach towards. So yeah. The first couple, I'd say the first 2 weeks was a bit weird. It was like, I was having anxiety or like panic attacks. I was like, I have no purpose. I have no drive. I have no goals to do anything. And that was something that I hadn't really experienced in my life. So I sort of have calmed down a lot since then. And sort of found that I'm doing stuff that I really like to do. I'm just doing more stuff that I wouldn't normally get to do over the summer. I mean, it is quarantine and it is like social distancing, but I'm still able in Canada, you're still able to go outside and still get activities in as long as you're not putting yourself in too much danger. So I've been able to like get out and ski and snowmobile and, I don't know, sort of just have a little bit more of a laid back lifestyle than the full training, full racing schedule. And I think that that's been something that's really beneficial because it's opened my eyes to stuff that I will want to do when I retire, when I quit from racing. Mm-hmm. And it sort of makes me more hungry for when the racing comes back around because life's really fun when you don't, like, I don't have to do anything besides go ride my bike or go just chill, I guess. But it's weird not having that competitive side of life and I actually really miss it. So I'm really looking forward to whenever we get back into the tape.
Yeah. Have you backed off the training a little bit then to give your body a bit of a rest? And
yeah, I did for a couple weeks, but I'm basically back into it now. I have a date that I think I want to be race ready for. And so I've been doing a lot of trail riding, a lot of pedaling, and I have a small home gym set up where I'm at right now. So I'm able to do workouts in the house and staying fit, staying strong.
Excellent. Good stuff. Well, we're getting close to the end of our time, but we've got four questions that we ask everyone. So we'll hit those up. The first one of those, if our listeners had £150, which is about 260 Canadian dollars at the moment, mm-hmm. to improve their performance on a bike, what would you recommend they go and spend it on?
A bike tune-up. You see a lot of people around with pretty beat-up bikes, and I think that having a well-maintained bike is huge for performance. Or I would say go get yourself a set of pylons and find yourself a dirt road and just work on flat cornering and cornering position.
Pylons, what, yeah. Like little cones?
Yeah, exactly, cones.
Okay, what, so lay out a corner to try and work,
yeah, exactly,
around.
So you sort of set them up down a road and you can like work on your cornering position, your position on the bike. It's something that's super basic and I did a lot as a kid, but it really helps in my eyes to I don't know, film yourself, do that, and you know, sort of choose things to improve upon while you're doing that.
Okay.
It's sort of like skiing, you know, you like ski the gates over and over again to prove your technique, and it should be the same with biking. You set these cones and you just do it over and over again until something works, you know?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. All right. Second question. If you could wind back the clock and sit down with yourself age 16, what advice would you give him?
16, 4 years ago.
What have you learned in 4 years?
Slow down. Not, I guess, in general, and definitely enjoy the things you get to do because you're not living the average life for a 16-year-old.
Yeah, sort definitely.
Definitely feel, I don't know, I'd say thankful and lucky to be able to do what you're doing.
Yeah, cool. Third question, if you could have a coaching session with anyone past or present, who would it be and what would you want to learn from them?
Sam Hill. Is it in terms of biking?
You can have a biking and a non-biking one if you want.
Okay. All right, we'll go. First one, basketball. Larry Bird teaches me how to shoot.
Okay.
And then in biking, I'd say Sam Hill, and he teaches me the ways of cornering as he does.
It's like, I would say 90% of people on the podcast have asked to be at a corner like Sam.
Yeah. And
like, it's amazing that even you guys struggle to work out how he does it.
Yeah. It's something pretty, I don't know. I was actually just watching, some of his race runs. Pink Bike posted a thing about Champery 2007, maybe when it started raining, and he still came down into third, but it's just like this ability. It's like everything he does, he's steering from like the back of his bike almost. Yeah. It's this, I don't know. And it's just so fast and I don't know, blows my mind.
Amazing stuff.
Yeah.
All right. Last one. What do you do every day that you feel benefits you?
I'd say play video games makes me happy. I don't know, just doing something that I want to do rather than maybe I feel like sometimes I'll go riding and I'll be like, oh, like I don't want to do this. It's just training. And I think that getting away from that and just doing something that you want to do is always beneficial for your own state of mind.
Yeah, definitely. What's the go-to video game of choice at the moment?
I'd say NBA 2K or the new Call of Duty.
Okay. There we go.
Some both hot very recommendations. Good games. Very good, good
stuff.
Game. Yeah.
All right. Well, if people want to follow you throughout what hopefully will be a bit of a race season later this year and keep up to date with what you're doing, what's the best place for them to find you?
I would say Instagram, at Finn Isles, or on YouTube, also Finn Isles, for a bit of a behind the scenes look into my life.
Yeah. How's the vlog going? Fun.
Yeah, it's really good. Actually right now it's a bit, I'd say it's a bit hard to film anything because we're not really allowed to. We can't really get out and do cool stuff or crazy stuff, I guess to say, but we're still doing small stuff around the house and or around our area. And yeah, it's really fun. I live with the guy I film with, and he's one of my really good friends. His name's Thomas, and we just basically spend all of our days together sort of filming and just doing fun stuff. So that's a very cool thing for me to have.
Yeah, it's quite a lot of work though, vlogging, yeah?
Yeah, I'd say so. I think he does most of the work, but okay. I just have to show up and not be too stupid. And we have a vlog.
Happy days. Well, yeah, we'll stick links to the Instagram and YouTube stuff in the show notes so people can find that.
Perfect. Thank you.
Wicked. Well, thanks a lot for your time, Finn. It's been super interesting chatting. And wish you all the best when racing finally gets underway.
Yeah, thank you so much. Good talking to you.
All right, that's it for this episode with Finn. I hope you enjoyed listening. Massive thanks to PNW Components for supporting this episode. Don't forget to head to pnwcomponents.com and check out their awesome range, and make the most of being a downtime listener by using the code PNWDOWNTIME at the checkout for 15% off during May. That's PNWDOWNTIME, all one word, all lowercase. Also, check out what they're doing with PNW Cycle 2. That's over at cycle.pnwcomponents.com. All the links are in the show notes for this episode over on downtimepodcast.com. If you've got a couple of minutes spare, then please leave us a review wherever it is that you listen to the show. Give us a follow on social media where we're at Downtime Podcast. Subscribe to the show so you get all of our episodes delivered straight to your device. And if you want to help support the podcast, then share the love at downtimepodcast.com/shop. Also, keep on spreading the word, tell your friends about the podcast, and share our episodes on your social media. Don't forget to check out Downtime Live too, where you can watch all of our previous live episodes and set a reminder for our upcoming episode with Chris Kilmurray, which goes live at 8 p.m. BST on Wednesday the 20th of May. You can find that at youtube.com/downtime mountain bike podcast. All right, we've got another awesome episode coming up soon, but until then, look after each other, and if it's okay to do so, then get out and ride.